The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have made it to start. Four, three, two, one.
Into the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to seven continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the theme of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners, and welcome to a Tuesday evening Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Great to be here again. Thank you all for tuning in. A great night in the San Francisco Bay Area. I hope wherever you are, it's equally as pleasant. This is one of those nights where I could wish I could do the show outside in the yard, like I used to do some of my college classes, but that's not going to happen. Anyway, great to be here. We have an exciting program for you tonight with Bob Zimmerman. So let me run through the announcements, and then Bob and I will kick it off with news about Star Trek. Bob already knows the news. The toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. And remember, no call screeners. Please let the phone ring. We'll bring you up on air just as quickly as we possibly can. Also, remember, we only have the one toll-free line, so if you get tired of waiting, send me an email and ask me to move it along, and I will be happy to oblige. And then for those of you wanting to use email, tonight we're using Dr. Space, DRSPACE, at thespaceshow.com. Remember, we're copyrighted and trademarked, but we do let everybody, in fact, we encourage everybody to download our shows and to share them and pass them around. A 90-minute show is roughly 44 megabytes. If you need to know how to do that, please let me know, and I'll be glad to help you. I use a program called WeTransfer.com, and it works pretty good, and it's pretty simple. Also, we're podcasting, and Andrew over at Gigadial.net does our podcasting for us. And you can find on our website the RSS URL to subscribe to our podcast. We're in iTunes, Microsoft Zoom, AstroSpaceNow.com, YAstro.com, Podcast Alley, and a host of other places on the net. If you have any podcasting questions, especially for your smartphone other than a Windows phone, I probably can't help you much on a Windows phone, please do email me, again, drspace@thespaceshow.com. That is our website. We have a detailed newsletter that is there. It goes up Sunday evening, so it has all of the details of our week's program, guest bios, and it's the only place we have a future events section for the show. And remember that if we have to modify our schedule, and that does happen from time to time, that modification shows up first on the website newsletter. So do check it from time to time. You can also sign up for the very short email newsletter that we send out early Monday morning, California time. Or just send me your email address if you want to subscribe. Everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of our website, or you can easily download the show. There's a store up in the upper left-hand corner, Space Show Gear. There is a guest search tool button near the social media button. That will list all of our shows, and there you can do global searches like you can in Word or Excel for your keyword, your key guest, anything that you want to try to search for. When you find that information, you are able to write that down, and then you can pull those shows up by date on the Space Show search engine at the bottom of our homepage. There's also the Support the Space Show button on the website. Remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with One Giant Leap Foundation.org. And while many of you get the Space Show content for free all the time, trust me on this, it's not free to produce. It runs off of 7 computers and all sorts of other information with a lot of maintenance. And that's why we're a nonprofit, and we're always asking for your support of the Space Show to help us keep going. And we thank you for your support, and hope those of you who haven't yet supported us will do so in the very near future. Remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, then you do get a tax deduction for your donation, and the same is true for those of you that pay California taxes. So the other thing I want to remind you is that we are partially sponsored by and brought to you by the Secure World Foundation. They promote cooperative solutions for space security. You can get much more information about their fine work off their own website, www.swfound.org. And they also produce and sponsor, they don't produce, but they sponsor our webinar series. And we have one coming up on artificial and partial gravity, an update with Joe Carroll and the group, and that's going to be toward the end of May. So check it out and, you know, tune us in. Okay, for tonight, Bob Zimmerman is back with us, a guy that really needs no introduction at all, given that he is the guest who has been on the space show more than any other guest, and that number continues to increase as Bob returns to the space show 4 or 5 times every year. So he is so far out in the lead of being the most frequent guest on the space show, other than those of you who call programs from time to time, like John and Doug and a couple of others, that nobody I think is even close to you, Bob, as being on the show that often. But Bob has a great website that you all should be checking daily. Maybe multiple times daily. I don't know how often he updates it.
At least half a dozen times, if not more, a day.
Okay, behindtheblack.com. And it's not just about space. It's about all sorts of science and current events that are going on and some political things and things like that. And I assure you, once you start going to it, you'll go to it at least once a day. He's written many, many different books. The Universe in a Mirror, The Saga of the Hubble Space Telescope, Leaving Earth, Space Stations, Rival Superpowers, and The Quest for Interplanetary Travel. And, hey, we may be leaving the space station soon. We can talk about that. You may have to retitle your book, Bob. And
let's still have Rival Superpowers going on here.
Right, and you still have your book about Genesis 8. Not Genesis 8, Apollo 8, that went around the moon on that Christmas.
That's the e-book that's been out. It's available by e-book in a new edition with great color images throughout rather than black and white. And a new foreword by me and Valerie Anders. So, yes, that's doing good, Grin.
Okay, so just so listeners will know, I sent the information to Bob before the show. We now understand why Star Trek Voyager under Captain whatever her name was, Kate Mulgrew is her real name, got lost in the Delta Quadrant. She thinks the sun orbits the Earth.
No, David, I have to come in here. I emailed you back, but I looked at the web pages involved with this.
They changed it, according to what Kelly said.
I think she's already sent out a press release saying she was misinformed about what the film
was
about.
Oh, yeah, she's humiliated. She's trying to cover
herself. Let me finish what she says, and I think actually based on a quick scan of the situation here, she's not the only one that's infuriated by the film. She said she was a voice for hire. She was hired to be the narrator.
And
that makes sense to me. She's not... They bring her in because she's an actress with a good voice and knows how to read, and so they get her to do the narration, and she just did it. And she says, I'm not a geocentrist. In other words, the story here is that supposedly this is a film that says Copernicus was wrong and that the Earth is actually the center of the solar system and the sun revolves around the Earth. And she's denying that she's a geocentrist now. And actually, based upon the film and the dishonesty of the film itself and the lack of reality of the film, I tend to think that the filmmaker is more to blame with all this stuff.
Bob, but this explains why she got lost in the Delta Quadrant. You have to understand, she probably flunked Starship navigation, you know, or something. I don't. Didn't she take over the Starship command after someone else got killed or something?
I never watched Voyager at all. My wife and actually are right now watching all of The Next Generation and the original Star Trek. We alternate episodes.
Well, those are the two best.
Yeah, and it's very interesting to watch those. But I never saw Voyager, and Diane, my wife, didn't like it, so we'll never rent that. And maybe this is why. I don't know.
Well, I mean, 7 of 9 was the best part of it. But I think she took it over after it was already thrown for a loop into the Delta Quadrant. I don't know, somebody who's a Star Trek freak will call in or something and let us know. But now we do know that she flunked navigation probably, and that's why she got lost. She probably thought the Earth, you know, was in the Delta Quadrant, for all I know.
All I'll say is this. The story you sent me is not going to get posted on Behind the Black. It doesn't meet the stink sensor in my brain about how reliable it is, nor the information within it. And even if it's true, it's one of these stories that doesn't deserve too much publicity.
That'll teach her to take on a job which she doesn't know what she's doing.
Yeah, I mean, I will say this. If she was hired as a narrator, they give her a script to read, you read it.
You want to know if you can, like, why would you do it without reading it first and knowing that it's BS or something?
Yeah, I just agree.
Wouldn't do it. Anyway.
Anyway, let's talk about some reality mixed in with fantasy here.
So you wanted the space station to leave orbit and use it as an interstellar or interplanetary spaceship, but we may be leaving the space station.
No, that's not going to happen. In fact, today...
What's that noise?
Are you there?
Yeah,
I didn't do anything. That was interesting. All right. Anyway, so today, it's as John Batchelor would say, it's the Phobosians trying to prevent me from talking about the Russians
or the NSA.
Yeah, or the NSA. Anyway, so today we had really big news from Russia. This will put everyone in relief. It'll just put your mind at ease. The deputy. Of the deputy director of the Russian space program, space agency, said that they are not going to, they're not planning any retaliatory sanctions against NASA or the U.S. government in relations to ISS. Earlier this week, you know, NASA announced that they are going to halt all Russian contacts except those they do with ISS. And since what they do with the Russians is 99%
ISS,
it's basically a pinprick, and they thought it was a joke, and they were laughing in Russia about this. And now they're basically, and they're saying, you know, it's pretty stupid. The harm it'll do is harmful to science and not to ISS. And they've now said, we're not going to do any retaliatory sanctions, which is, in humor, I said, wow, what a relief. But the truth of the matter is, I never expected them to do anything.
Nor did I.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, those sanctions, as I said, are so minor, they mean nothing to Russia. The other thing is, I guessed immediately who these sanctions were aimed against. They're not aimed at Russia at all. What they are an effort to highlight to Congress how vulnerable our space program is because it's dependent on the Russians. And if situations get hotter or more tense, then yes, ISS might be threatened at that point because we can't get astronauts up there without Russian help. Now, Russians aren't going to go away. They're not going to back off from us because they need us to operate the station. We provide the electrical power and most mission control operations. So they aren't going away either. Plus, they need our money because we hire them to launch our astronauts. They need that cash. So they're not going to go away. But nonetheless, this is to highlight the vulnerability we have to Congress because it is Congress, both Republicans and Democrats in certain districts who have influence in Congress who want to cut the commercial space program that's going to get us the ability to put humans back to ISS. They want to cut that program so they can put the money into the PORC program, the Space Launch System, which isn't going to get us anywhere and is not going to get us back to ISS for sure. And so I think the Obama administration is playing it's a pretty shallow, callous, transparent lobbying effort, but nonetheless, that's I think what its intent is. I'm not, by the way, in disagreement with the position they have that we should be focusing on the commercial space effort, which will be cheap and fast and get us manned capability. But it's still a crass and pretty obvious, transparent, the most transparent presidency in history. This is very transparent. Yeah, their lobbying effort.
So you think we're going to be doing business with the Russians in space for all time to come?
No, I didn't say that. I just simply think that at least for the near future, We will continue the cooperative effort at ISS. In fact, as long as ISS is in orbit and we are participating, we will be cooperating with the Russians in its operation, because the Russians don't have at the moment the wherewithal to replace ISS. And if they could, I think they would. And in the coming years, they're going to be thinking about setting up their own space station independent of us. I think that's already being discussed. I'll bet you that's already being discussed in the Putin administration, because they don't like, they like to have their own independence just like we do. And I think it'll become especially apparent to both the U.S. and Russia when the Chinese begin to do a space station and it's better than both of ours. That'll be help raise the stakes a bit. But for the foreseeable future, at least, I think we'll be working with them. When we get our own capability to launch our own humans into space, it gives us a lot more strength at that point. If we did have that capability, we would have the ability to tell the Russians, you're being pushed out of ISS, because the station can function without the Russian modules at this point in time.
Well, but they have the agreements with Russia, so...
Well, what does that have to do with anything? I mean, this is politics, global politics with politicians. I mean, you're not suggesting the politicians are honorable and will keep their word, are you, David?
Yes, of course.
Well, I'll give you an example with the United States. I mean, we had an agreement with Europe to participate in the launching and building of the ExoMars rover mission to Mars. It's a European Space Agency effort to put their own rover on Mars, but NASA was contributing a significant portion of that, including the landing capability.
We broke the agreements.
And we just walked away. We told them one day, and the Obama administration said about 2 years ago, well, we're just not going to fund it. Goodbye, we're done. And so they were suddenly stuck with scrambling to replace it. Who replaced us? The Russians replaced us. So the Europeans and the Russians now are trying to make ExoMars happen in 2018, and the Russians are the ones who are picking up the slack. All I'm pointing out here is that promises mean nothing. I was at a astronomy conference, for example, David, just about 2 weeks ago. This is for an article I'm doing on for Sky and Telescope on the big ground-based telescopes that exist right now on Earth. And at this conference, it's a conference having to do with the uses of the Large Binocular Telescope in Arizona. And about three-quarters of the partners who own that telescope are from Germany and Italy. It's actually Italy's national telescope in many ways, and there's like a whole bunch of institutions in Germany that also use that telescope. They're owners of it. There's also American partners, but there's a lot of big partners in Europe. And in the discussions, they're talking about using the telescope and how it operates and other issues. I was talking to a woman who's involved in a new European Space Agency probe that's going to look for exoplanets called Plato. It's a very clever spacecraft. It's very cool. But she said, we don't want to make deals with the United States because you guys are very unreliable on these kind of matters.
What's it called? Think-to?
Plato.
Oh, Plato.
Plato, as in it's very clever. And the idea, it's going to be an optical, it's going to be more than a optical telescope. It's going to be a multi-optical telescope. It's basically to characterize and get a good close look at exoplanets. And it's going to observe about 1 million stars. And the idea is to try, it's very similar to Kepler, but a little bit more sophisticated. What's really cool about it, it's going to be an array of 34 individual telescopes mounted on an observing platform. So it's going to have 34 small telescopes and, you know, kind of like on the ground, the big telescopes are often segmented mirrors.
Right.
Well, in a sense, this is what this is going to be. It's going to have 34 small individual telescopes, all with an aperture. Each one will have mirrors of about 12 centimeters. What is that? That's about 12 centimeters. What is about 4 inches, something like that. So they're small telescopes, but they're up above the atmosphere, and they're going to be, you know, unified into one piece. And that'll get you a telescope, when you put it together, with a combined area of almost a meter. That's That's still not as big as Hubble, but that's a significant telescope, and it's optical, and it'll be in space, and it'll be looking for exoplanets. So anyway, she was telling me how they've gotten this program approved, and they're building it, but they don't want to partner with the U.S. because we're not reliable. So when it comes to ISS, to tie up this all together, if we get a manned capability, we will at least be in a much stronger bargaining position with the Russians if we start to get tension between the two countries.
You already have a caller on hold. Are you ready for this?
Sure, I'm always willing to take a caller.
We've been having some toll-free phone line problems, especially with cell phone users, so hopefully tonight will be a better night. No, it's not going to be. Caller, are you there?
Yes, this is Marshall.
And you're on a cell phone, right?
Yes, I always use the same cell phone, same location.
It's really horrible. Do you hear the modulation?
Yes, I hear the background stuff, and it's kind of like, that's bad. Anyway, your comments about a new space station and the Chinese putting up one. What was the year of the final design for the International Space Station?
the International Space Station's Marshall. By the way, thank you for calling. I haven't heard from you for a while.
Oh yes, I always listen to you. But if I'm out on the farms, I have to listen after the show. So.
Well, anyway, the International Space Station, you know, when was its final design? I mean, we could argue about that. It'd go into enormous, remember, it was originally a freedom in multiple design things. They changed it so many times that at one point in the space agency and contractors were not calling it Freedom anymore. They were calling it Fred because they were so disgusted. And then it got dumped by Clinton and became the International Space Station in partnership with the Russians. And I would say the design we've got today was more or less finalized in the mid-90s during the first few years of the Clinton administration. By 95, I think they pretty much were, and they were using, you know, components from Freedom and some of the design ideas from Freedom, so that made it possible to do the redesign very fast. But they were essentially finalized around 95. Now, I think where you're going is, well, gee, look how many years, it took them almost a decade to get the thing, more than a decade to get it completed. The Chinese are not building this kind of space station. They're building a Mir-type space station. It's going to only involve the launch of between 3 and 4 modules that will link together at a node, very similar to Mir. And then it's just a matter of cost and time, because, you know, this is a very smart way to do it. It's kind of like the Falcon Heavy. You don't come up with a new design for each module. Each module is essentially repeating the previous, so you don't have to, you save a lot of money. And you just keep adding them. It gives you more habitable space in a larger facility. And so that's what they're planning. They have a very slow pace. So it's not going to be tomorrow, but they're talking about starting to launch this thing sometime around 2020 at the latest.
Can SpaceX beat them?
Can SpaceX beat them?
Yes.
Well, SpaceX isn't really building a space station per se. You know, SpaceX is in the business of right now. It's in the rocket business, which is to launch commercial satellites and commercial cargo to ISS for profit. I mean, I know that Elon Musk wants to go to Mars, and that's his dream. But the company's plan is, you know, that's what it's doing. It's not building a space station. There's nothing on, I have not seen anywhere any indications that they're building a space station. I don't think that's even in their dreams at this moment in time. We're talking about separate issues. Will private space beat the Chinese might be a better question, Marshall.
Okay, fair.
I would say that if SpaceX and the launch industry continues to evolve where costs keep dropping, I think that, yes, private industry will beat the Chinese. In fact, it already has, since Bigelow's has launched 2 modules already successfully, test modules. So, if you've listened to my shows, you know where I stand. I don't want to have to, I'll repeat myself. I personally think that the private space system will work. Private space will get this stuff done faster and cheaper and quicker. And I think we're seeing a demonstration of that with orbital scientists and SpaceX right now.
Marshall, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. I enjoy listening to you, and I could take off just like you do, ridiculing friends of the administration, but David would get upset with me. So I'll let you go and have fun.
Okay, thank you, Marshall.
Bye.
I should add, David, that if you read my webpage, you know that any listener will know that I don't have a lot of respect for the Obama administration as a general rule, and I think it's actually a very corrupt administration for other reasons. But in talking about space, they have generally been, I think, that the NASA under Obama has actually had the right idea more often than not. Not always, but more often than not, especially when it comes to commercial space. So it's not merely that they're Democrats, I don't like them. It's by policy, and when their policy is right, I'm going to say so.
Of course, a lot of people don't agree with you on space policy. So.
Oh, of course. But
it doesn't seem like many of the presidents really take it to the mat and really fight for a space policy.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing, though. The Obama administration sure does seem to be doing that, though. I mean, this sanction thing here is an example of that. This is something they could have just let slide and not do anything at all. But for the sake of the lobbying effort in Congress, they made this move. And, you know, their attempts to kill Constellation, you know, at the time I was more or less in favor of Constellation because that was all we had, but with no enthusiasm because it was a big space thing. And the Obama administration just cut it, illegally cut it. And of course, what that produced in my mind was a mess, and that's what we've had for the last 5 years. It's one of the reasons we have not been able to replace the shuttle yet, because it's a mess. You got Congress and the Obama administration fighting over what should be done, and a lot of money's being spent, and there's no unified vision here. The Obama administration could have done a better political job of working with Congress to try to get commercial space as the way to do it. Instead, they didn't work with Congress very effectively, and the result of that is that Congress went off on its own and developed SLS. So you have a political war going on, and anyway.
Jerry in Denver sent in an email and said, why is SpaceX delayed on their launch?
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, we want to talk about that. This most recent delay actually has nothing to do with SpaceX at all. It has to do with the fact that they're launching out of Kennedy. It's a rocket that's Falcon 9's taking Dragon up to ISS. So it's a NASA mission, essentially. NASA's the customer. So they're going to launch out of Kennedy. And when you launch out of Kennedy, the Air Force is the range officer, generally. It's the one who monitors the range and gives approval that the range is clear. And they also monitor the rocket to make sure it's not going to go land where it shouldn't by accident. And they have to be able to track it very accurately. And the Eastern Range at Kennedy, they had a fire in one of their radar facilities about, 3 weeks ago?
Uh-huh.
And it destroyed that facility. Bad damage, and they thought they could get it up and running pretty quickly, but after a day or so, they said, no, it's not going to work. We got to replace this. It's going to take a couple of weeks. No launches can occur. And so it wasn't just SpaceX that got delayed for a couple of weeks. There was also an Atlas V military payload that was scheduled to launch like 2 days later, much sooner than SpaceX, and it got bumped as well. And so they've just this week announced they've rescheduled all the launches. The military payload's going to go on April 10th, and SpaceX is now scheduled for April 14th, the Falcon 9 launch. And so it wasn't SpaceX at all. SpaceX had delayed their initial launch date by about a week to 2 weeks. Incrementally, they had stretched it out a bit because they had a lot of issues they wanted to just make sure they had all their dots in a row. That's at least what they said, and, it makes sense. For one thing, they are launching this rocket with legs, and they're going to try to take the first stage, burn engines on the first stage after separation, and try to bring it down to the ocean softly in a vertical manner, under controlled manner. And that's to test eventually to make the first stage reusable. And so they had some issues there they wanted to take care of. Then they had an issue with their I don't know if this was their fault, but the cargo on Dragon. Very shortly before their initial launch date, they had to call a halt because they detected what they called contamination in the unpressurized trunk section of Dragon. That contamination was, there are some insulation blinds. This is a section that is not pressurized, but it carries cargo that doesn't need to be in pressurized situations. But it carries with it insulation blankets around the cargo to protect it from temperature changes. And it turned out that those blankets had oil stains on them. And they had to look at that closely, because when you get into vacuum, some materials, oil included, some oils, will, what they call outgas, will turn from, oil stains to oil gas, which could interact with electronics and cause arcing and fires. This is some of the stuff that they learned in the very early days of the space program back in the 60s. So they had to look at that more closely. It turned out it wasn't an issue. The oil stains came, it appears, from the sewing machine that was used to sew the insulation blankets. It was sewing machine oil, as it turned out. So that was another reason they delayed. But, you know, once again, their track record is, as far as I'm concerned, superb. There are always these little issues that have to be dealt with. It's how you deal with them that determines, to my mind, how good a company or engineering you have. And they deal with it. They don't let things slide. They don't look the other way. As has happened in the shuttle program a few times, they've been dealing with every problem as it comes up. So that's the story. And so our launches are about to proceed at Kennedy, and hopefully SpaceX will succeed. I'm very eager to see that first stage attempt. I'm hoping they'll have cameras on it and we can actually watch as it comes back to Earth. I really hope that works very well.
You have an email from St. John, New Brunswick. From Phil Backman. He's over in the Department of Physics. He contacts the show all the time by email, but can't call the toll-free line from there. Bob, you mentioned that you suspect one day the Russians will once again have their own space station. I'm curious how separate are Russian and American activities now on the ISS. I ask because I occasionally come across information that seems to indicate that the Russians strictly hang out and work in the Russian end of the ISS by themselves, while the Americans and other international partners occupy the other end.
Oh, that's interesting. That wouldn't surprise me, but I don't think it's, you know, there's a lot of reasons for something like that. For one thing, the Russians have their own experiments just like we do. And so they're off working on their experiments. It's not so much, and similarly, I'm sure if a Japanese astronaut's up there, he's doing the experiments that he's been sent up to do from Japan, and while the Americans are doing theirs, and the Japanese experiments are going to be in the Japanese module, the Kibo module. The Russian experiments are going to be in their modules. So there's going to be a certain isolation in that respect just because of the work they do. For example, and this is an interesting thing, and I'm pretty sure it's still the same thing on ISS. There are some American universities that have been doing plant experiments on ISS where they're trying to grow plants. But they've made a deal to do that with the Russians, not with the Americans, because NASA is too bureaucratic. It's very difficult to get the experiment approved. So this is a case where the Russians are doing experiments with American scientists, and the American astronauts on ISS were forbidden to eat the vegetables. The vegetables were being grown. These are things like lettuce and tomato and like spinach, leafy vegetables. The idea of, one, can you make it work on space? There's a lot of engineering issues behind that. And if you can make it work, it can provide food to the astronauts. It provides a certain morale boost because you're growing plants, a gardener. It really helps. And so the Russians have been doing this through their whole space station programs for decades. They did it on the Salyut stations, they did it on Mir, and they're continuing it on ISS, but in this case they're now working with American scientists to do it. And but when the crop comes through, they they are forbidden, the American astronauts are forbidden to eat it. This is because NASA has its rules about food and so forth, and this stuff might not be safe. And contrary, on the other side, the Russians, they don't want to give it to the Americans necessarily, because why not? They want the fresh vegetables
for themselves.
They should eat it. Now, I mean, obviously, they would offer some to an American, but there's separation. So, yeah, it's an interesting thing he's bringing up. I'm sure there's some separation, and there's some cultural separation as well. I mean, language-wise, they're all supposed to speak English when they're together. The Russians, at a certain point, it's just like we would. They'd rather work together and speak, at home, speak their own language. And so those issues come up, I'm sure. The issue also is that the Russian space program has always been very aware of why a space station gets built. They know what the purpose of a space station is. It's supposed to be it's a prototype, it's a planetary spaceship. And they can't really do that research like they'd like to on ISS. NASA has prevented them from doing it, and the station itself is not designed well along those lines. So you can't even do the good engineering you need to figure it out, the kind of work they were doing routinely on Mir. So they're frustrated in that respect, I know that. They have been lobbying for a decade to do year-long missions, if not longer, on ISS. It's the ideal place to test simulated Mars missions. And it's taken years to finally get NASA to approve a year-long mission next year, starting in 2015. We're going to have a year-long mission. A Russian and American astronaut will be up there for a year. And it wasn't NASA who came up with this idea. NASA joined it reluctantly. It was the Russians who were pushing it. So they want another. They would love if they could afford to put their own space station up at some point. I know that.
Well, they could take their module and separate it, I understand.
Yeah, but they have problems because their module does not have the power capacity. They depend on the main truss that we built with the giant solar panels for power.
Uh-huh.
And it's not a complete station. It wasn't, some of the modules there they have launched and are going to launch were originally built for Mir 2. This is going back now more than two decades almost, but they were actually built for Mir 2. But when they joined in with ISS, they didn't have the money for it, but they abandoned building all the necessary components for a complete self-sufficient space station. It let us take up some of the slack. And because of that, their module can't operate on its own. It would have problems, especially for electrical power. So they have to add a lot more to their half of the station to make it independent and self-sufficient. And I think in this case, it probably would behoove them to start fresh. They might be able to move a module over once they've got a new one established, but I don't think they can add to what they have quickly and get a station.
And, of course, when they have a breakdown or a problem, that everybody seems to work together to resolve it.
Yeah. It's best to be understood that it's not just that we need the Russians to get our astronauts up into ISS. The Russians need us to keep their station functioning because, once again, the power comes from our part of the station. Much of the mission control operation, the computer operation, comes from our half of the station. So they can't just walk away either. And it's also financially, they have much less resources to replace this station than we do. That might change in the coming years. Actually, I'm not so sure it will. But if it does change, that they will gladly take advantage of that. But right now, they need us as much as we need them to keep the station operating.
We've had a couple of programs over the past 4 to 6 weeks that seem to point out some challenges, I use that word rather than problems, for Virgin Galactic. What's your take on what's going on over there?
Well, I've talked about this on your show as well, David, and I've reported it on Behind the Black a few times, and I think Doug Messier at Parabolic Arc has done really good work digging into this to get us some good background on it.
Right.
My sense of the situation is that there are issues at Virgin Galactic that they're not talking about. I think the most significant piece of news I saw about this in the last 3 weeks, actually only maybe 2 weeks ago, is Brian Binney, who's worked for Scale Composites now for, what, almost two decades as their test pilot astronaut. He's the man who flew Spaceship One to win the X Prize. He's been one of the test pilots at Scale Composites for years. He jumped ship.
Went to X-Corps.
And went to X-Corps. Now, there's a lot of reasons why that might have happened. I have no inside information about why he made this decision. It could be he just was getting a promotion and better pay. That's a possibility. It could be he's getting a promotion for sure. That's possible. But it struck me as very interesting because of the timing. For him to do this now, when Virgin Galactic apparently is getting very close, suggests that maybe they're not getting as close as it appears, that he sees his chances of flying might be dimming somewhat there. And X-Corps, you know, Jeff Greason has said on his web, on their website, there's an interview of Jeff, and he says he's the head of X-Corps. He says that they hope to do test flights, their first test flights of Lynx, their suborbital craft, this year. Now, I take that with a grain of salt, as I would take a grain of salt now from most of these companies, but that's what he says, and he hasn't said that up to now, so they're getting closer. And Brian Binney's jumping ship makes me think he knows maybe something we don't. X-Corps might not be that close, but it might be telling us that Virgin Galactic is farther than we think. And that's my impression in every way. Once again, there have been very few power. There's been no additional powered flights. You'd think they'd be flying them much more often. And the nature of whatever power flights that have occurred with the hybrid engine has fit the story, which is that they can't run that engine for very long because the vibrations become unstable and it's not controllable. And there's been two powered flights and both of them were under 20 seconds. And that's so that fits that model. And there's been no evidence of any other work while nothing's happening. And I don't see why nothing's happening. Something should be going on here. That suggests that there's engine issues and they're trying to come up with a replacement engine right now.
So you haven't picked up the phone and called Brian to find out what's going on?
No, I haven't done that. I haven't done that at all, and I'm not sure he would tell me. I'm sure, in fact, he wouldn't tell me about problems at Virgin Galactic because I'm sure, for one thing, he has signed, It's contracts, which says you're not supposed to give away information. And so even if he jumps ship, he can't give away information, so he's not going to tell me anyway. If he tells me, it'll be off the record, and even that is tricky, because usually in this situation, you keep your mouth shut. And I wouldn't blame him.
Email from Carl in Boston. A couple of weeks ago, Fox News did a special about the decline of America, and space was one of the components the panel of experts talked about. They all seem to think that we are in a decline in space because our space program is basically not doing anything. They clearly don't agree with you, Bob. So did you see the program, and what is your take on it?
I did not see the program. It doesn't surprise me. You know, our academic intellectual community, as a general rule, is very tunnel vision, left wing. I'm sorry.
Guys weren't left wing. I saw the program.
Well, even if they're not left wing, so you have an advantage on me there, David. But even if they're not left wing, the modern intellectual thought generally doesn't see a space effort as possible unless it's a government program. He even used those words. Our space program is dying right now. Well, as you've heard me say on this show, is I don't want a space program. I don't want the government running it. I think we'll be much better off with a chaotic free enterprise aerospace industry with many competing companies trying to make money at this effort. And so I don't think it's in decline. I think we're in a transition period. And this is what I've said for the last 4 years since Obama dumped Constellation and tried to put in commercial space. We're in a transition period. It's going to take us a while to make the move from a space program, Soviet style, rule from above, government dictates how we do it, to a private enterprise, rule from below, free companies or individuals making their spaceships and competing on the open market for business. And we're in that transition. And when we complete that transition, we're going to be sitting here with multiple companies capable of doing the kinds of things that China can do. Or, you know, China have one thing. We'll have multiple companies. Russia will be able to do one thing. Russia's just consolidated everything back into a one Soviet big corporation government run. So they're going to have one thing. We're going to have multiple companies with many different things competing creatively, and I think that's going to be a benefit. So, no, I didn't see the show, so I'm speaking, you know, totally guessing here, David. Tell me, you saw it. What do you think? How right am I? Am I wrong, completely off the cuff?
Yeah, I think you don't match anyone's perspective. So, and even the people who seem to support more or less commercial space and what Obama's doing, they're not opposed to the government still being completely involved and partners with the space community. So you're more out there in left field, probably.
Right field.
On your own, or right field. Well, when you go so far in either direction, you join up. So, you're probably joining up at some place. The guys that they had on were
by the way?
I don't remember.
Okay.
And
no one you remember, no one like.
Well, no, they're real famous big people. They're
Logsdon?
No, they weren't space people, but they were famous people that do political comment. We could probably look it up.
Okay. I don't know the
maybe,
name.
Maybe Carl or somebody who saw it will email.
Sure.
So let's see, the Kirsten, the Democrat was there. I forget her name. Kirsten Powers.
Oh, yeah,
there.
Okay.
I think Krautheimer was on the panel.
Okay.
I don't remember who else was on the panel, but
political pundits on the news, basically.
More or less.
People.
And
okay.
So their view, well, first of all, they're not, whether they're space advocates or enthusiasts or not, I have no clue, but they certainly aren't steeped in the industry and the technology that people who listen to this show are. So
I will just insert here, David, I made one assumption that was absolutely wrong. I was assuming these were academic experts. They were not.
No, they're more the political
pundits.
Yeah, they're more the,
okay.
the Fox crowd that does political pundit stuff.
Okay.
And they represented both the left and the right. But they're more or less traditional aerospace, so the fact that they don't see a strong government program, and they see, you know, NASA kind of floundering around, and they don't take the asteroid retrieval mission very seriously.
No one does.
No one does.
Not even Obama takes it seriously.
So,
nobody.
So, you know, that's why the overall impression on the 15-minute space segment was we're going down the tubes fast.
Okay. All right. Well, that's I'm glad you clarified, because my assumptions, some of them were wrong. I think you're right 100% when you say they're not experts in this field. They just see the superficial outside. You know, NASA's program isn't doing anything, and so that's where they get their conclusions from.
Yeah, I remember. You know, Krautheimer used the line about Bolden saying we need to help the science values of the Muslim countries
when he
first came to power. So he used that in one of his comments. But I don't remember. I remember him on the panel and Kirsten, and I don't remember who else was on.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing. I'm reading a book right now on the first, like, decade of the aviation industry. This is, like, from 1903 to a night, like, just before World War II. And that period of time, you're basically the planes that existed then were nothing, were only slightly different than today's human-powered planes. They're very simple. They're just basically lifting, you know, wings give you some lift so you can put a body and a motor on it. It's very small vehicles. They're just basically flying contraptions. And how did this industry get going? Well, in this case, you had enormous number of contests and awards and prizes being offered, and you have a lot of people improvising engines and equipment and scrambling to come up with ideas and then making money by selling. If they want a prize, then new people entering the field would buy their plane, and they'd make money on that. And then the new people would look at the plane and say, well, I can do something better, and they would build something, and then they would enter a contest and win and sell their plane. And so you had very fast. This was mostly going on in France, by the way, not in the United States initially. But in France, you had a great deal of innovation and creativity going on from around, I'd say, especially beginning around 1906, a few years after the Wright brothers, through the early years of the next decade. Very innovative. And this was not a government program. It was mostly newspapers offering prizes for contests and therefore subsidizing the industry by selling newspapers. Very creative, very innovative, and I think very successful in the end. We ended up with an airplane industry.
You have a follow-up note from Phil in Canada.
Okay.
I would be curious to get Bob's thoughts on what has happened to Inspiration Mars. Was it just a question of lack of money that forced it from a private venture to a never-going-to-happen government lead Mars voyage? Contrary to what Charlie Bolden has said, I thought the original 2018 private Mars flyby was extremely inspirational. So, Bob, before you answer, Philip, go back through the archives a couple of weeks, and you'll find a show I did on the Space Tech Conference in Long Beach, and one of the guests was Tabor McCallum in Tucson, that does the life support for these missions. And we asked him about both Inspiration Mars and the work he had done as a consultant for Mars One. And if you want probably a pretty good update on where Inspiration Mars stands, you want to listen to Tabor's comments.
Can you summarize it, Dave?
Yeah, but I'd rather hear what you say unless you're not following it.
Well, I'd be curious, first of all, what he said.
For the most part, they wanted the government to pick up the cost. That doesn't look like it's going to happen. They have a fallback plan to go in 2021, which swings by Venus, within 500 miles of Venus, and it adds about 95 days to the mission. So there is that possibility, but they need a rocket like SLS to do it. And right now SLS is not going to be ready. Let's assume it's ready at some point, okay?
Assume it's ready on their schedule as announced.
So,
it won't be ready till 2025.
And they want to use it for 2018, which probably they wouldn't be able to.
No.
And it's questionable about 2021 or 2022. I forget which
range it is. It's not going to be ready. It's not.
And they need a big, capsule or something as
right.
well. They're working on the life support. It's very hard to do.
Okay.
And it's going to be extremely risky, but they believe that they at least have a fighting chance at survival and coming back okay. So that's kind of the standard for it.
All right. So now that doesn't contradict anything of my...
Nor anything general. I've been picking up in the scuttlebutt world.
But it's not...
It depends on how you want to rate the possibilities for it being a go. So I rate it very low.
It doesn't change my opinion from the beginning. I always thought there was almost no chance this was going to happen as they announced it. But I thought the original idea was very inspirational and the right idea. Tito was trying to get American leadership out of the doldrums, come up with something inspirational, do something a little braver. And he was proposing doing something a little bit braver and more interesting, and I applaud that entirely. But I always have felt that they were somewhat ignorant. Everything I read from their paperwork always struck me as they were somewhat ignorant and naive about the actual technical problems. When they made their announcement and they came up with their, what I call PowerPoint engineering last year, of their proposal for using NASA architecture for getting this mission to happen, it was very clear to me that they hadn't the slightest idea of the technical problems. They were just doing PowerPoint engineering. They were putting wonderful graphics together. Well, if we put this piece with that piece, we'll have that and we'll have this, and then we can do these many days. Well, there we go again. We'll have these many days. And it was, I thought, naive at best about what the problems are. And I think they're still faced with that issue. That doesn't mean I'm against their effort. It's just that I think they've been very naive about the difficulties. And asking the government to do it is, of course, unrealistic. It's not going to happen. I mean, SLS itself doesn't have a clear goal. As I said, no one believes the asteroid mission. No one takes it seriously. None of this is being taken seriously by anyone. And that's partly because we've had a track record now of 40 years since the Apollo missions where these kind of declarations have been made by presidents over and over again, and none of them ever happened. So no one's taking Obama's declaration seriously. First of all, we all know that he doesn't really believe it very much. He's just made an announcement that no one takes it seriously. And secondly, we also know the track record. New administration will come in and they'll dump it. They'll do something else instead. So that's Inspiration Mars, I think, is a great inspirational idea, but that's about as far as it really is.
Yeah, I don't think it'll happen, and I'm even more skeptical about Mars One.
Yeah, and the Mars One thing is it's public relations. It's clever public relations. I'm not against their effort. No, I'm not against it, but I try to look at it with a cold eye. How realistic is this? I just don't see it happening. Now, I could be wrong. David, I'm scanning the news to try to figure out what fantasies have the most likelihood of becoming realities rather than just looking for fantasies. And, you know, it's like when Elon Musk came along a decade ago, it struck me as this is a fantasy that is grounded in reality and will maybe go way beyond that his original fantasy. So I took it very seriously. But something like this, they're getting the cart before the horse. That's how I look at it. They're looking, it's like, I've told this story before. This is after the Columbia accident. I'm on coast to coast. We can't fly anyone into space. You know, it's going to be years before the shuttle is operational again. And I get a call asking me, well, what do you think about terraforming Mars? And it's let's focus on our problems right now. And this is the same thing, trying to make believe we can make a mission to Mars when we yet don't have the launch vehicles to get the cargo up to do it, the payloads up to do it, and we don't have the infrastructure, the spaceships in space, the big capsule, as you said, to transport the people there. Let's deal with those engineering challenges first, and then we'll be in a place where we can go anywhere.
Phil in Canada sent in the panel members on that Fox show.
Okay.
So it was Kirsten Powers, who's a Democrat, George Will, Joe Trippi, who's a Democrat, and Krautheimer.
Okay, and that's the standard pundit crowd. They're going to have their positions. Some of them will be a little more knowledgeable than others, but we both know.
Well, they're traditional.
They're traditional, and they're also going to generally be, more important than anything else, not in-depth know a lot about the situation right now. They're not going to link, by the way, even if they know about SpaceX, they're not going to link what SpaceX is doing to the possibility of having an American space program.
They'd have to be under a rock to not know about Elon and space.
Yeah, I'm saying they do know, but they're not going to link that to a space program. They're going to think of that as commercial space, getting satellites in orbit, the launch market. They won't link that to the potential of an American effort to explore the planets independent of the government. They just won't see it. And that's not their fault. That's just, they're not experts in this field. They don't follow it like we do.
You have another caller on hold. Hopefully we'll have a good line. Hi, caller. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead, please. Who is this?
My name's Tony. I'm from Seattle.
Oh, Tony. I couldn't tell.
Hey, Tony.
Hi, Robert. Hey, April 14th here, coming up, SpaceX could land a first stage in the ocean. improve reusability. What do you think of that?
It's one of those fantasies that's grounded in reality, and grounded is no pun intended. I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens. I'm hoping they'll have cameras on it and they will let us see as much as we can of its success or failure. Musk has been honest about this, and engineers on their company have been honest about this. They don't expect to be very successful in this effort initially, because it's not easy, but it's an engineering test. They got to see how the avionics work, how to control the engine, how to fly a first stage back to Earth. No one's ever tried this before, so it's really a difficult task, and they're going to just give it an effort and see what they can learn from it and go forward. Because of that, I look at it just like they do. It's an engineering test, prone to failure. It is the purest engineering tests, actually, we've seen in space in many years, in many ways, because it's not like they have a payload. It's not like the return of that thing is crucial to their future success. They're trying to come up with better engineering, and they're testing it as they go. And if it doesn't succeed, they just proceed with what they learned to try to figure out how to do it better. But it doesn't change the operations of the company. There's one component of the Falcon 9, this test, that not many people have talked about that concerns me a little, which is the addition of the legs to the rocket. They are aerodynamic if you look at them, but there is a concern in my mind. Rockets go through extensive atmospheric drag and force as they go up, and we know that with the shuttle. And I hope they have done sufficient testing of the addition of those legs on the rocket that it will not affect the rocket in a way they don't expect. And this is that's an unknown here that not many people have talked about. You add these legs, you change the aerodynamics of the rocket, and I hope they have done the due diligence necessary to make sure it's not going to be a problem.
Well, they tried a similar return of a first stage over the Pacific.
Right.
Apparently, the stage is going Mach 6, and they brought it down to 100 miles an hour before it hit the ocean surface, the Pacific. That's 96% of the delta V there. They almost did it.
I hadn't heard that. What I had heard about their attempt to return the first stage on their previous effort was they very quickly lost control of the rocket because of fuel sloshing issues in the engine.
No, let me tell you, Robert, this is what happened.
Okay, I'd love to hear some inside news.
They lit three engines.
Yeah.
Okay? Very early, it was still supersonic when they lit three engines. Then they relit one engine, but for some reason they have figured out a spin developed.
Yeah.
And the spin centrifugally forced the fuel away from the tank inlets of the
bottom
of the tank. And that's why the last little bit of fuel couldn't be used to bring it to a vertical speed of cruise.
Oh. Well, that's very interesting, because that what you're saying then is, because of the sloshing, they couldn't access that last bit of fuel, which meant they couldn't get rid of the last bit of delta V. That's what you're saying.
Right. Apparently, the attitude control system on the first stage was unable to overcome the amount of spin that was developed. Now, the big question is, why did that spin develop?
Yeah, that's, well, okay. Well, this is what they're going to be trying to deal with on the next launch, right? They're going to be testing again. They're trying to figure I'm sure that's one of their prime engineering questions. Can we figure out where that spin came from the previous launch on this launch?
Exactly. And it's like, what do you do to the attitude control system to beef it up enough to handle these accidental spins that develop? It's a question. It's research and development.
Well, you don't work at SpaceX, do you?
No, I don't have that privilege.
All right. So the question I have, and I don't know if you can answer this or if anyone in the audience maybe can answer it, is most first-stage rockets don't have side thrusters, as far as I know. Have they installed a variety of side thrusters on this first stage to give it some control as it's coming down?
Apparently, there are attitude control thrusters on and designed into the first stage of the Falcon 9. It was designed to have to be reused. And they actually were they were holding 30% of the payload capacity back to provide fuel for these tests.
Yeah, I know that.
That's
one of the reasons they're doing them on the Dragon launches, because they have spare capacity, they can still fulfill their contract with NASA. But that's interesting. So they have side jets, attitude control jets. That's all right.
They weren't big enough. That's the problem.
Well, who knows? I mean, there could be other factors involved. The spin, you know, it could be, it's like one of the early Falcon 1 failures was because they just simply didn't have the right baffles within the fuel tank to keep the fuel from sloshing in the raw and produce, you know, that resonance vibration that eventually put the thing out of control. Well, they might be able to solve this, not with bigger thrusters, maybe with other things. I'm speculating at this point. I find this very interesting information. I really am hoping that the next launch we see some of this go on, and I wish them Godspeed, SpaceX. I mean, I really hope it works, because, boy, if David and I were talking about the problems that the other companies have with SpaceX because of the challenge, and if SpaceX gets its first stage reusable relatively soon, every other company in the world is going to be in real problem, because they will not be able to match the prices even close.
Yes, SpaceX has been talking about 500 a pound to LEO.
Yeah.
They get these stages reusable. Hey, anyway, thanks a lot. Keep on going. I love the show, David.
Thank you, Tony.
On,
bye-bye.
Thank you, Tony, for calling.
We need to take a break, but real quick, what do you have to say about President Clinton saying he wouldn't be surprised if we ended up being visited or worse by E.T.? Any comments, please?
I mean, who knows? It's a variation. I mean, Bill Clinton says lots of different things, big deal. He's a politician. But it's a variation of the old question, do you think there's life out there? And the old statement, you know, there are so many planets, the statistics says there should be. So if the statistics say there should be, it's perfectly reasonable to think that aliens have come visit us before. That's absolutely possible, but it's mere speculation from a science fiction perspective. It doesn't really tell us anything new, because I mean, he has no. I don't think Bill Clinton has any inside information on alien visitations. I could be wrong, but I don't think so.
Well, you know the stories about Jimmy Carter and his comments about wanting to bust open the E.T. stories and Roswell, and somebody asked him about that when he was being asked to autograph a book, and he almost went into tears and said it's one of the one things he's not allowed to talk about. And the Curtis LeMay story with Barry Goldwater is another pretty interesting story. I mean, there's a lot of these stories that, if you're into all of this and the conspiracy theories and everything, you can keep yourself busy for the rest of your life.
Yeah, I tend not to focus on them, because I always come back to the bottom line, that if real alien evidence was obtained, you couldn't keep it secret, because there's too much. It's too beneficial to too many people's careers to be there as part of the discoverers. So it's just not possible to keep such a thing secret. That's how I look at it. They can say so, but I just don't see it's possible. If they had picked up an alien ship and it's hidden in a military base out in Roswell, trust me, that would leak out in a real
way. Yeah, but if they put pictures of that out there, nobody would believe it. So,
We've never had the kind of pictures that the real legitimate pictures.
What do we know? What a real legitimate picture in.
From a journalist's perspective, as a journalist, yes, you can tell the difference. There's a difference. I look, and every time I look, that doesn't pass the stink test.
Well, if somebody knows, if Bill has inside information, let us know.
Hillary, let us know.
we'll take our break and be back in a couple of minutes. Don't go anywhere.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible. The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible. The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Tuesday night Space Show program. And for those of you listening, you're probably not watching television. So I will read this CNN bulletin that just came in that Bob doesn't even know I'm going to read it. Ocean Shield has been able to reacquire the signals that are consistent with airplane locator beacons on two more occasions, both on Tuesday, said Agnes Houston, head of the Australian LAD search effort on Wednesday. It's Wednesday in Australia, folks. Ocean Shield has now detected four transmissions in the same broad area. I believe we are searching in the right area, he said. This was a news conference a little while ago. So thank you all for listening to the Space Show instead of CNN. Bob, it's interesting that they use a lot of space assets to try to find that plane.
It's common sense.
And some of them are private. Even some of the small CubeSat things were used.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, for the private companies, it's good publicity if they can come up with, be the ones to find the thing.
And be helpful, yeah.
Yeah, so that's their focus is that. Secondly, you know, there's a certain law of the sea type thing, you know, where you're supposed to help, you know, distressed ships, and people feel a need to want to help. Forget about publicity here. If you have the capability that might solve this mystery, you want to use that capability, and so that's why a lot of these private companies come in.
Look what the U.S. Navy did with that stupid couple that took their kids on that sailing trip down around Mexico, around the world, with a one-year-old and a three-year-old, and we had to go rescue the kid.
Yeah.
And I wonder if they're going to bill that dumb family. You know, that must have cost $1 million or more to go pull that rescue off.
Yeah, I can't. I don't know.
I don't know either, but people want to help people.
Right. I mean, and so sometimes, you know, it's like, for example, in Arizona where I live, in the southern Arizona area, there is a rescue service here that will provide free rescue for you. If you get lost on a hike and they have to helicopter you somewhere, you don't pay for anything. But if you go up north to the Grand Canyon and you get into trouble,
different story.
They charge you. And the reasons are actually very logical why one place they don't and the other place they do. Because here in southern Arizona, the amount of problems are not so severe. It's not so frequent. The people who do go hiking are generally people who know what they're doing, and the ones that don't are exceptions to the rule. And so you can deal with it. You can handle it. They don't want people to – they want people to call for rescue as quick as possible because that's better. And so they want to encourage you to call. But in the Grand Canyon, you got a very large number of people visiting the canyon who very quickly do stupid things, are out of their league. They move down into the canyon, sometimes foolishly. And so after a while, they finally decided we have to discourage people from being a little too foolish here. At least they should be aware that it's going to cost them, even if they get back alive, it's going to cost them the cost of the rescue. So therefore, use some caution to begin with. So there's logic to that. But I would say in most cases, you know, rescues are free. People don't get charged because you just want to get people back. You don't want people to die.
Listeners, Bob and I were talking during the break, and we were trying to think of what's really new, what's different that we could talk about that we don't always talk about. So for those of you out there listening, if you know of space stories or space news or space something that we're not talking about, call us or email us and let us know what you think is new and different and unique. We want to hear from you, and you have a caller on the line. You ready for this?
Sure.
Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
Tim from Huntsville.
Hi, Tim.
Another lousy cell phone. Make it quick, Tim, because you're modulating again. It's hard to hear you.
Okay, quick question. I'm going to get off the line.
I thought you got a different cell phone that worked really well for a while.
Oh, it stopped working, didn't it?
I don't remember. I just remember it was not your typical cell phone. You got some kind of a different phone, and it worked pretty well.
Okay, I'll have to...
go check it out again.
Okay, a quick question. Dr. Livingston's guest yesterday was talking about going to some islands in the Pacific to launch rockets because of ITAR restrictions. What is the private space community trying to do is working on to change these laws?
Well, there's been effort by several different companies for years now to try to put some pressure on. There has been some changes. There was the changes made earlier this year to the ITAR regulations to kind of loosen them up a bit. I know that, but I don't know the the legal, the specifics in great detail to know how serious they are right now. David, you probably know the specifics better than I do right now. I know there was a change to the law which people hailed as an improvement, but I don't know the specifics.
Well, Tim is talking about interorbital that would like to go to Tonga to avoid American launch laws. This has nothing to do with ICAR. The fact is that launch laws with the AST and needing a launch license and all this stuff are needed no matter where in the world an American citizen or green card resident goes to launch, or if the rocket has American components in it. And that's not ITAR. This is what you have to do to get a launch license. So you could go to the South Pole, and you would still need a launch license if you're a U.S. citizen or you got American parts in the rocket. They were, because Interorbital sells their TubeSat kits and CubeSat kits to foreign countries, they're considered a munition on ITAR, and they have to get an individual ITAR permit to export that kit to Brazil or England or wherever it's going, and they make sure that you're not selling to any on the restricted list, and then there are some countries that they don't allow you to sell to because it's likely once you get the product in that country, it'll be transferred to one of the countries on the no-go list. So it's a little bit different, but I understand they are making some progress in weighting the tiers on ITAR, like an A list, a B list, a C list, to make it a little bit easier, and some of the easier ones are going back over to Commerce rather than State Department. But I don't know the specifics of it and the actual progress.
I can't add anything.
Long story. It needs to be resolved because, come on, for a little TubeSat kit to be on a munitions list, give me a break.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you could launch pencils from space, and if you could get it down through the atmosphere, you'd have a hell of a weapon.
Wouldn't get it through the atmosphere. That's the point.
Well, you probably wouldn't, but you could probably launch something that you could that's not a weapon here on Earth. I mean, everything's a weapon. A pencil, a pen,
right.
A key,
right?
You know, my frying pan.
Right.
So maybe we could launch frying pans. I wonder if that would be on the ITAR list.
We'd be going from the fire to the frying pan.
That's right. What else, Tim? Tim, are you there?
That's it.
Okay.
Thank you for your call, Tim.
I don't know if you got the email, David, but I sent you an email about two news science stories that came out this week that I think are of significance that we should talk about that have less to do with commercial space, but I think are important for planetary exploration down the road. And one has to do with I have to be careful how I phrase this. One of the moons of Saturn, Encetalus, has exhibited evidence over the decades that it might have liquid ocean under its crust. They have what they call, it has what they call tiger stripes at one of its poles that seem to vent steam, and they're thinking that's volcanic action, but with instead of lava, you've got water as the lava. And so they know that steam coming up, and so the question is, where's it coming from? It's coming from underground, and so there's been theories that there's an ocean there. And last week, using orbital mechanical data from Cassini that's been collected now, and it's now, what is it, almost a decade in orbit around Saturn, maybe more than a decade, they have gotten a lot of gravitational information about Encetalus, and so the scientists have said that gravitational data confirms, to them at least, that the density of Encetalus and its makeup almost certainly has an underground ocean, and that of liquid. And they say the moon itself is only about 300 miles across in diameter, and they say that lake would have the volume of about Lake Superior, and that's significant for the size of that planet, that moon. And this is really interesting for future exploration because not only is the liquid water of use to future settlers, it's liquid already, you don't have to add heat to make it liquid. But there is always the unknown, and this is getting back to the question of alien life. There's always the possibility. You have liquid water and energy. You have the potential for life. And so that's a piece of news that I think is really interesting. I'm a little careful about it because, you know, we don't have actually direct knowledge of this ocean, David, but we do have now additional data that confirms the theory. And so the weight of evidence is beginning to lean towards the existence of an underground ocean there. And if it can happen in Enceladus, that suggests it could happen elsewhere, such as Europa orbiting Jupiter, which is a much more exciting possibility because it's a larger moon, closer to the sun, more energy because it's in the orbit around Jupiter, and therefore much greater possibilities for, once again, water and energy and life biology. That's an exciting story I wanted to bring up. And the other story, David, has to do with LADEE orbiting the moon. LADEE's primary purpose for orbiting the moon was to answer the question, did the Apollo astronauts see dust levitating off the surface of the moon? When the Apollo astronauts were on the surface of the moon, several of them reported on the horizon seeing a glow. And the only theory so far that I've read to explain that glow is the possibility that the radiation from the sun was hitting the surface of the moon, hitting the dust particles, and causing electrostatic reaction, which would static electricity levitate the dust off the surface for periods of time. And it's a controversial theory. They're not even convinced that what the astronauts saw was what they think they saw. So this has been a very questionable mystery about the moon. And it's important because if the dust on the moon can be levitated by radiation, it creates an incredible environmental obstacle to using the moon for, as a base, as well as for doing scientific research. Because obviously if there's dust flying about periodically, that dust in itself is very, is a problem.
It's really toxic and corrosive, yeah.
Yeah, it's a problem. It's the nature of the shape of the dust particles. They're very angular and sharp, and so they wear into things, and they wear things out, and therefore they can do harm to your lungs if you breathe them. So there's issues there. And if you're doing, let's say, you want to put a telescope on the moon of any kind of observations from the moon, the dust is going to be an issue. Well, so that was LADEE's primary purpose for going to the moon, to try to answer this question. Is the dust on the moon levitated? Does it have a slight atmospheric effect here where, you know, at the terminus is where the astronauts thought they saw it, you have a change in hot night to dark, and therefore it causes a reaction, and you got dust in the air. Well, you know what? I saw an article just this week talking about how they're going to be crashing LADEE onto the moon as its mission is over. And as an aside, the article pointed out, just as an aside, that by the way, our data hasn't answered this question. We don't know yet. Let me quote the project scientist, Rick Elphick. So far, we haven't come up with an explanation for that, which is the bizarre glow on the horizon. One leading idea is that the sun's ultraviolet rays cause lunar dust particles to become electrically charged. That dust turns the lofts upward, forming a cloud that has caught the light in the astronaut's eye. Well, they had an experiment. They measured a signal. And what they got is that it wasn't there. They didn't get it. So that suggests that the dust doesn't get lofted off the surface, but the trouble is that the astronauts saw something. So what did they see? And so this remains a question, and it's an important one for future settlement, and it's not been answered by LADEE. We don't know yet what was going on. We might not be able to answer this question until we have lunar surface probes on the surface experiencing it periodically. That may mean we have to put a base there first with humans to look and deal with the problem once it manifests itself.
Okay, we're getting some people giving
with
us
ideas.
Something, new ideas. So,
new news. Okay.
So, okay. Joe in Chicago, the underwater ocean may be where the Malaysian airplane is.
In El Satellus?
That's what he says. I guess he's trying to be a...
Whatever he says.
He's trying to be a smarty pants, but
yeah.
I went ahead and read it. Okay, another one.
Yeah.
Karen in Seattle, and she is saying there are news stories breaking tonight, especially out of the UK press, about a rare astrological tonight heralding the end of days because of the Mars, Earth, and other planetary alignments that are very, very rare.
David,
do you know anything about this rare alignment?
David, have I suddenly, am I, are you suddenly, morphing into Art Bell, and is this coast to coast?
It might be more entertaining.
I did get an email from one of your regular listeners who pointed out a good story. I haven't actually posted it on
my... Well, this is a real I read the story after I got her email, and NASA's commenting on it all over the place, so it is a real story about this rare planetary alignment and four blood moons that are going to come right in succession that hardly ever happened.
Yeah, so, you know, that's an astronomical event. It's a lining up of the planets. It's kind of cool. It's interesting. It's not going to end the world, that's for sure.
I don't think so either.
No, I know so.
Unless you happen to pass away during this event. Then the world ends.
That's a different end of world. It's not the end of world. That's end of you.
But people, if you want to see the pictures of the blood red moon and to read about this event, do a search for Mars Earth rare alignment, and you'll probably find a dozen articles and a lot of pictures.
I did get an email, by the way, from one of your listeners. I forget his name, and he has an email address that doesn't tell me his name, but that's okay. The story he pointed, I didn't post this on my website yet, but it's actually a very cool story. It has to do with Naval Research Lab. Has actually, using chemistry and research, they've come up with a way to produce jet fuel from rocket fuel.
Yeah, I got that too. That's,
from seawater.
Yeah, that's from Tony, who called us a few minutes ago.
Okay,
it's
very interesting. It's an interesting story. It appears the chemistry is pretty straightforward, and they're claiming that the cost for doing this is somewhere between $3 and $6 a gallon of fuel, which is competitive. So if this is true, it is a big deal, and I hope so. I tend to want to see. You know, I've read these stories for my whole life, and it never turns out to be the big deal everyone says it is. But it sounds really intriguing and somewhat exciting. If so. One report I read about this claimed that this actual chemical process would be, from a green perspective, carbon dioxide neutral, that you'd be pulling carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere in the process. It's pulling carbon dioxide dissolves carbon dioxide out of seawater. And so that carbon dioxide is the fossil carbon dioxide that's being put into the atmosphere and then dissolves in the ocean. So you're not really adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere by burning this fuel. You're taking the carbon dioxide out and then using it to make fuel and then burning and putting it back in again. And so that's an interesting perspective of this as well. The obvious, most biggest benefit, if it turns out to be true, is the almost limitless supply. You know, once the technology gets robust, you don't really have to. Not only do you not have to depend on penny ante mad dictators in the Middle East for your fuel, but you don't. It's everywhere. It's very easy to get. So that's an interesting story that we should keep an eye out over the near future.
Unless you drain the oceans.
I think that would take a lot longer than there's a lot more seawater on Earth than there ever was oil, and even after 100 years, we're still not close to finishing up the oil on the Earth. The oceans are quite vast. I wouldn't worry too much. It would be a long time before that happens.
A couple of weeks ago on another show, I want to get your take on this. I asked a question about the emerging CubeSat market because the barriers to entry are pretty low. You're seeing kids in low levels of school, you know, grade school even can do a simple CubeSat kit.
Yeah.
The bottleneck, of course, is getting a launch for your CubeSat. But I asked the question, because the barriers of entry are so low, including the cost, could this be an industry that just grows and grows and then goes bust because it's overextended itself given the demand, kind of like other industries that get a hot start and then they fall flat?
Well, what always happens when an industry gets a hot start and then or busts is it doesn't disappear, the industry. What happens then is that's the weeding out process, and the industry matures, and the companies that do it better continue
survive
to sell their products, and
right.
it exists. It doesn't die. Well, in the CubeSat industry, I think, yes, I think this is a future. You know, once again, As innovation in the launch industry starts to improve, you're going to start to have launch companies catering to the CubeSats. I mean, prime example is Virgin Galactic. Their wish to build what they call Launcher One, which is designed almost exclusively to launch these kind of tiny satellites. It's not going to have the capacity to launch anything else, but there is a market there. They recognize there's a market there, and there's a potential growing market. There was a story I posted on Behind the Black about these two high school students who, I think they took a space satellite construction course somewhere, and they were taught how to build a CubeSat. So these two high school students said, well, what the heck? We know how to do this. They immediately put out a press release, and they formed a company. I don't remember the name of their company, but it was basically, you need a CubeSat built? We'll build it for you. And why not? This is the way it works. So,
what are you going to do with the CubeSat they build for you?
Well, it depends on. It's not a question. If you have an idea, they're willing to provide the service of construction. So, I mean, there are companies. You know, you have the Flock one that was just launched. They're putting up a lot of CubeSats. Well, if they need someone to build it for them, if they're project, but you got to hire someone to do the construction. So these kids said, well, we'll do it. And so they're looking for work. It's just, there's an industry there, and I think it will grow. I don't worry about the possibility that that a large percentage of the companies that get started at the beginning go bust, because they are just a generational, it's the first generation. Look, I've mentioned that aviation book I'm reading now. None of the airplane builders of the first decade of aviation became a household name. None of them. They did not survive into the next generation. They all disappeared. But they all developed innovations and laid the groundwork for later industry generations that produced more sophisticated airplanes. And it would be the same thing here. Same thing.
Okay, so listeners, if any of you do have other ideas or new developments specifically in space, let's hear about them.
I'm just, you know, it's not like we don't have stuff to talk about, David, but I'm really tired of talking about, like, for example, I mentioned this earlier to you before the break. We could talk at great length about Ariane Space's CEOs who are both their past and present CEOs who've admitted in public in several different forums, and I've posted this on Behind the Black, that SpaceX beats their prices by anywhere from 40 to 50%, and they can't match it, and they don't know what they're going to do, and they're trying to figure out how to survive in the industry. And I could talk about that at length. I'm kind of – that story is an ongoing story. It hasn't changed in any way. It just keeps getting additional confirmation.
As I told you, I know the president of the American Ariane Space, and I'm working to bring him back on the space show. So that may happen in May, and I'll give everybody a heads up if that's going to happen.
Yeah, I would be very curious. I don't, you know, Ariane Space, we've talked about this at great length, and we're in that transition period. Nothing's changing at the moment. You know, we had hoped 2 years ago that Virgin Galactic would start tourist flights, and it hasn't happened. They promised it 2 years ago, then they promised it last year. Now they're promising it this year, and nothing's happened. So we're kind of like waiting. And so with Ariane Space, it's a very interesting situation. They have a problem because they have They can't quickly come up with a replacement for the Ariane 5 that will be cheaper. Their new CEO, this guy Stefan Israel, I think is his first name, but I know Israel's his last second name. He's actually been pushing through some interesting reforms. ESA and Ariane Space is designed basically as a, like NASA, as a pork passer.
A government project, but they are not unusual for those countries.
No, it's not. But what let me get to the point here, Dave. The way they designed is they have many subcontractors scattered throughout the European Space Agency to distribute the money, you know, just like we have pork in the United States with the congressional districts getting distributed about so the congressmen are happy. And that's how Ariane Space is structured and has been structured. So they've got like 250 subcontractors that help build Ariane 5. Well, Israel has forced through for their future work that the number of contractors is going to be reduced to under 100, even less than that. Like 70 was the number I saw. So what he's trying to do is streamline the company for future construction projects, the next rocket, so that it can be more efficient and therefore cost less. And so that's one of the things they're trying to do to reduce it. But as you say, they have a serious problem because they are still a quasi-private company, and there are politics involved in how they build their rocket.
And they're government-owned industry.
Yeah, and so they have a real difficulty in coming up with a quick design fast that can be up on running within a reasonable amount of time before they get wiped out. They had an audit done. They hired a French company to do an audit of Ariane Space to try to figure out what they're going to do next. And that audit included comparing how Ariane Space does things with to SpaceX. And the audit pointed out that what SpaceX did to develop the Falcon 9 rocket was to minimize its risk. They developed an engine, the Merlin engine, and rather than develop a new engine for the second stage, they used the same engine throughout the whole rocket. And then they just simply multiplied the number of engines they used so that they reduced the risk. They didn't have to develop new engines, new stages, new designs. Well, that audit pointed out that the way Ariane Space would do this when it's developing a new rocket, and is what they are talking about doing for Ariane 5, the update of Ariane 5, is they would put up design teams to develop a new engine for the second stage and a new engine for the first stage, and it would be a totally separate parallel research projects, and each engine would be new, and therefore each engine would carry with it a great deal of risk because it's a new design project. And they pointed out that we maybe should look at how SpaceX does things to maybe find ways to minimize our risk and increase our success rate and reduce our costs. So they're once again scrambling to try to figure out how to handle this situation. Russia is taking a very interesting tact to dealing with this situation. They have decided that competing independent companies are not the way to go. They have decided that we're going to go back to the Soviet era, one government-run operation. Everything is consolidated into a single corporation, and the government is going to dictate what they build. Is it going back to the Soviet Union in this respect? And it's, to me, very interesting because I don't see how they can compete on the open market under this framework. I just don't see how they're going to do it. But that's the decision they have made. The thing about this is that all these different competitors are making drastic decisions or scrambling to try to figure out how to deal with the lowered costs of launch that SpaceX is introducing into the industry. And that's why the CubeSat industry has potential because, you know, they get attached to other things. You know, they get launched as an attachment, as a secondary payload. But as the launch costs go down, it'll become more and more likely that they will be the main payload on a launch.
I have another question by email.
Okay.
Joe Bob in Atlanta.
Okay.
What's the latest on Dream Chaser?
There are several interesting stories that have happened with Dream Chaser recently. One, which is that they've subcontracted Lockheed Martin, a division of Lockheed Martin that's based at Michoud in Louisiana, to work on the to work. I don't remember the specifics of what that division is going to do for the Dream Chaser, but they're now a subcontractor for Sierra Nevada. Lockheed Martin is a subcontractor to help build the spacecraft. And I thought that was interesting for several reasons. It struck me as what was going on there is that Sierra Nevada is putting is doing a little bit of political pressure. I mean, the Lockheed Martin engineers are good, and they'll probably give them good bang for the buck. But picking Lockheed Martin here gives them a little bit of political play in Congress and with NASA. It increases the odds that when NASA has to make a final decision on which cargo carrier it's going to use, that Sierra Nevada is in a stronger position. I thought that was politically what they were, was a good idea. Obviously, I was at a AI. I gave a lecture at an AIAA section in Minnesota last week, and one of the guys there, engineers, has been working on the avionics for Dream Chaser, and he says they do. You know, it's been a lot. He says it's been a lot of fun. It's really cool. He's doing new engineering, and they're very serious about trying to make this thing fly. And so I hope, what is it, Mike Strangolio? I might have.
Oh, Mark Sorangelo.
Sorangelo, thank you. My pronunciation is always faulty, but he recently said that no matter what NASA decides to do, we intend to finish this project.
Because they're in it.
Yeah, they're in it for real, and I think they're smart because once built, they have a launch vehicle that has great value because it will have the capability. Like the X-37B, it will have the capability of not only bringing payloads into orbit, but bringing payloads back, just like the shuttle. It'll have that possibility, and that is a value that right now only one spacecraft can do, which is Dragon. And so they're very smart to pursue this because they will be available to provide a need that there's a shortage of people who can do so. That's all the most I can say about it. They continue to meet their milestones with NASA in the commercial crew contract stage. The other thing is that they haven't certified that even though the landing gears didn't open properly and the thing crashed when it landed, that wasn't what they were testing on their glide test last during the summer. They were testing the ability of the craft to fly and then under controlled circumstance come back under control to the runway. And it did all that perfectly. If the landing leg had been out, it would have landed safely. And so NASA certified that as a successful milestone, and I don't think that was an unreasonable decision because the landing leg wasn't even the one they're going to use in the final craft. It was just something they pulled off another plane.
Yeah, it's from a trainer. It's a temporary thing.
Right. So that was a success. I've been trying to find footage, film, pictures, something of what the thing looked like afterward, just out of curiosity. But I think they did have a success there, and they're moving forward. I have great hopes for them to produce. I the three companies involved are Boeing, SpaceX, and Sierra Nevada. I think that Dragon is almost certainly going to get chosen. If NASA is not forced to down select to only one company, they're almost certainly going to pick a second, so they have two different ways of doing it. Right now, I think I would favor Dream Chaser. But Boeing, once again, is one of the big players, and there's politics involved. They might pick Boeing just because it's Boeing and a lot of workers in congressional districts. That's unfortunately some of the reasons why this happens.
Very interesting. So we'll see what happens. We're coming up on a 2-hour show, Bob. How about an uptake on the bat disease, white nose?
Oh, well, that's an interesting story, David. As to just give the newer listeners, I'm a caver. I do cave exploration. I've written science articles on bats for places like Science. 5-6 years ago, this white nose appeared in New York State, and it basically killed like 95% of all the bats. They think it's a fungus that was imported from Europe. It comes from Europe, at least, and it wasn't in the States. And the bats, what happens is in the colder climates, it specifically attacks bats that hibernate in the winter when there are no insects to eat. And what happens when they are hibernating is the fungus disturbs them so that they cannot stay in hibernation. And so they wake up in the winter when there's nothing to eat, they burn up their body fat, and they essentially starve to death before the end of winter. It's been spreading this fungus throughout the eastern United States, following the migration patterns of bats, the flight patterns of bats. There's no evidence that humans spread it at all. There's only evidence that humans have a possibility of spreading it, but the evidence is all 100% that it's the bats that are doing it. It's been slowly spreading westward and north into Canada. It hasn't in any significant way crossed the Mississippi yet. There's been some evidence of it beyond the Mississippi, but nothing very substantial. But it continues to spread, and it's continuing to kill bats. The evidence is, once again, as you move down into the more southern, warmer climates, the negative effects of the fungus, white-nose fungus, is less significant because the bats don't have to hibernate, and they are insects year-round. So they, even though they're annoyed, they just keep eating. The most hopeful thing that has come around in the last 2 years, especially in the last year, is that up in the Northeast, in the New York, Vermont area, which was the first hit by this, it appears that some bat colonies, some bats, are beginning to survive year to year and prosper. You've got very decimated populations, but the numbers that are still around, it appears there are now bat colonies that are beginning to recover. In small numbers, but they're recovering. It appears that now we're beginning to see bats that can deal with the fungus and survive, even though it's there. And that's essentially what we think happened in Europe, that this fungus appeared, eons ago, we don't know when, and it changed the bat populations in Europe. Bats in Europe don't hibernate in the same way American bats generally do. They tend to hibernate more solo, not in big groups, in that way. And it could very well be that was an adaptation to deal with the fungus. And it could be that that's what's beginning to happen now in northeast United States. It's going to take time. I have always said, David, from the start, that there's not much humans can do to stop this. This is Darwin under effect. Extinctions happen, and we have nothing to do with it. And in this case, I think we have very little to do with this. And in a sense, from a scientific perspective, it's a wonderful opportunity to observe an extinction process. We know a lot of extinctions happened in the past, but we've had very few opportunities to study a natural extinction process. There's a lot of extinction things that have occurred on because human activity has made this animal species suffer. But this is not one of those cases. This is a case where a natural occurrence has decimated the population and is maybe possibly going to cause some species to go extinct. So it's something that we can actually learn and study from to see how these processes happen, and also learn how maybe species adapt, because we might be seeing a very slow recovery of some of these species adapting under Darwin, adapting evolutionary-wise to a new environmental situation. That's the way it is right now. I live in Arizona now, which does not have any white nose, and from a caving perspective, it's complicated because you have to kind of keep the east separated from the west, because no one wants to see this come here. And so there's gear issues. I can't use the gear that I used back east in a lot of the caves here west, because they want to keep, even though I'm sure it has no white nose on it, people don't want to take any chances. And, I have friends visiting from the east, and we generally try to loan them gear, and they generally don't want to use their gear for the same reasons. If I go east to go caving, in fact, the times I've been east recently, I purposely didn't go caving because I didn't want to bring any of my gear back east and get it contaminated centrally. And so I didn't cave. it's an interesting sociological problem from a human perspective as well from this. So that's where we stand right now. There are some hopeful signs, but it has nothing to do with curing the disease. It has to do with Darwin and how a species evolves and adapts to a problem.
What should we be looking for over the next 3 or 4 months from space?
Well, it's always, you know, there are two, the stories that keep coming up over and over and over again is the unfolding private sector in space. How will SpaceX's reusability on its first stage work out? Will Orbital Sciences continue to, will both companies continue to successfully launch cargo to ISS? I think they will. What is Virgin Galactic going to do? And the other thing, too, is this summer, is X-Corps going to finally do some test flights? They say, Greeson said he was. It would be really interesting. They have always been the tortoise in this race. No one has even heard of them. Most people haven't even heard of them. I have been one of their biggest skeptics. I won't deny it. I've always been really, really skeptical of X-Corps in this matter, you know, but now so many years have passed with Virgin Galactic not succeeding with Scaled Composite Spaceship 2. We're looking now at maybe X-Corps very slowly, the tortoise slowly catching up with the hare, and maybe moving ahead. And so we'll see. That's something to look for. Keep your eye out on that. I would suggest that strongly. Keep an eye out on how, another thing, two other launches that are coming up. Russia is going to do a test flight, its first test flight of its new family of rockets, the Angara rocket. This is the first new rocket Russia has built in, what, decades, 50 years, half a century. And it's an attempt to try to upgrade and streamline and make more competitive their rocket systems. And so it's going to be interesting to see how that flies. India, after finally getting a successful test flight of its geosynchronous rocket, all home-built, they're planning to do a second test flight in a couple of months in June. And they have said that that test flight, it's a test of the rocket. But since it's only a test of the rocket, they have to put a dummy payload on. They've decided this dummy payload is going to be a engineering test vehicle of a manned capsule. They've already built the capsule, and the test there is to see if they can, if they can control it and bring it back to Earth safely. They've done a test like this about a decade ago, similar, but they're going to do it again. And I think India is becoming increasingly space happy in that respect. There's China, of course. I am drawing a blank on what their next Chinese mission is supposed to be. I'm forgetting whether or not Tiangong is still in orbit even. They've been so quiet and they go at such a slow pace. But they have space station plans and more manned missions down the road, and you should keep an eye out for them as well. What else is there, David?
Well, that's it. That's the world.
I think I've covered everybody. Russia, American space industry. You know, we have multiple companies coming in here.
So is space going to be a congressional 2014 issue with anyone?
Well, one of the reasons that those sanctions were put in by the Obama administration is because there are debates going on in Congress about the budget. The Obama administration wants to get so much money for commercial space, and Congress tends to be fighting that because the Congress wants to spend the money on SLS and Falk. And I think that battle is going to continue to go on this year. I think that the tide has settled in. I think commercial space is very secure right now. I personally do think, this is my opinion, I think politically they're very secure that the money will be there. The situation with ISS and the need to get American space forces Congress to continue to fund that program. They might not like it. They'd rather spend it on SLS, but it forces them to spend that program. The elections will change things, hopefully for the better. In terms of space, it's hard to say because it's been the Republicans who've mostly been interested in pork and big space. It's been the Democrats who you'd normally think would be interested in big government and big space who have been pushing private enterprise and commercialism. So this next election is probably not going to do well for the Democrats, and so it might not be great for commercial space. I personally think the politics right now are such that it's very difficult for commercial space to suffer. Congress needs to give Americans a capability of getting into space, and space SLS is not going to do it while these private companies are. And it just becomes increasingly hard to vote against commercial space as time passes.
Well, one can hope that you're right on that point.
Yeah, I mean, I could be wrong, of course, but I've watched the politics for years, and I just see this political situation. There was something, I haven't been able to dig it out of my brain, there was something that happened very recently that, I can't bring it out of my brain, there was something that would have very big political influence on the debate in Congress about SpaceX, and not SpaceX, but commercial space versus SLS. And it was, I just can't remember, but there are so many factors right now that are working against the space launch system. Its cost, its slow launch rate, its inability to provide the need of the country, which is to get astronauts to ISS at a minimum, and on a regular basis, that politically, it's a very vulnerable program, I think. I don't see it surviving. I just don't see it surviving.
Of course, they're not calling in tonight, but if some of the people who propose their lunar missions and things like that and want SLS for that purpose, they would be totally disagreeing with
you. Well, you see, here's the thing. There are plenty of things you can propose for SLS to do, and that very high-powered heavy-lift rocket will have great capabilities to put a lot of payload in orbit, to do a lot of things. I don't dispute that in terms of engineering. I look at what NASA has admitted is the launch rate, one launch every 4 years. Well, you can't go to the moon. You can't do anything with that kind of launch rate. You just can't do it. The rocket itself won't have enough launches to be engineering-wise robust. You got to use the thing to figure out how to use it. And if you don't use it that often, it just doesn't function. And so it's not even a question here of whether or not it could be used to go to the moon. It's not being built in a way that it can be usable. So that's where I'm coming from. And I mean, once every 4 years, you run the numbers, it's still pretty consistent. If you run the numbers, the operational cost of the standing army that keeps that thing going every year for the 4 years per launch, you come down to numbers like $10 to $14 billion per launch. It's absurd. There's no way that NASA can afford such a thing. And more important, at those kind of numbers, you don't have any money left over for any missions for the rocket. That's why no one takes the astronaut mission seriously, because there's no money and they're not building anything right now, really, to get us anywhere with this. They're going to have a capsule and a rocket, and they won't be able to go anywhere because there's no money left over. That's where I'm coming from, and it's not an engineering negative. It's just the politics.
No, their management of the program is abysmal.
Well, I mean, this is, once again, it's a pork deal. It's not even NASA's management. It's pork. It's been designed. They can't build it cheaply because they've got to, just like Ariane Space, they've got to distribute contracts throughout the NASA infrastructure so that every congressional district gets jobs from it. And that just makes it ungodly expensive. And it also slows things down so that they don't get it built very quickly, and so it's once every 4 years a launch. And that has nothing, I think, actually to do with NASA's management. That has everything to do with the politics of the program. And NASA, you know, what are they going to do? They're government employees. They've got to go along with what they've been told to do. I know that there are NASA managers for decades who've wanted to shut down whole centers to try to streamline the agency so they can do things more efficiently, like they did in the 60s. And they can't do it. Politically, it's not possible. So what happens in a situation like this is sooner or later, politically, when you've got finally a more cost-effective option that also brings jobs to districts, that cost-effective option wins the battle. And in this case, that cost-effective option is the commercial space industry, which will be able to do it much cheaper and faster and more effectively.
You have an 11th-hour call,
okay,
which we have to deal with quickly since we're at the two-hour point.
All right.
Hi, caller. Who are you?
Yeah, this is Tim from Huntsville.
You're calling again?
Uh-huh, if you don't mind.
Yeah, be quick.
Okay. Well, my question is, what's the argument against the Falcon Heavy as opposed to the SLS besides, oh, the Falcon Heavy launches slightly less than the SLS? I mean, the Falcon Heavy is actually closer to being cost of flying an SLS?
Well, you said it. Falcon Heavy it would lift once you've got the heavy version of SLS, it's about half the tonnage. This Falcon Heavy for the early versions of SLS,
a third of the tonnage.
Yeah, the difference is much less. It's not that significant. What is the argument for Falcon Heavy? There is no argument. There's no argument against it at all, other than pork and politics. Once again, the design of Falcon Heavy is smart in that what Musk and SpaceX has done is minimize their risks by not redesigning new engines and new stages. They're just simply taking what they already have that works and multiplying it. It's smart. It's smart. And so there is no argument. This is once again getting back to me. They're going to do a demo flight. They do it. Once they do that demo flight, they'll be doing it years before SLS. And they'll be offering a vehicle years before SLS that can do much of what SLS can do. At some point, the dim bulbs in Congress, the lights will go on, and they will start to say, well, you know, that brings jobs, too, and it gets it done now. Congressmen want photo ops. SLS don't give them that photo ops. If SpaceX and a Falcon Heavy starts launching, it gives them photo ops. They'll take the photo ops over the blueprints any day. So that's where I think we're going to go. That's where I think it's going to go. And, Tim, thank you. I think we're really pretty much done, aren't we, David?
Yeah. Tim, do you have anything else, or is that it?
That's it.
Thank you, sir. Tim. Good night.
Right. Good night.
Okay, Bob, and until the next time you return, and we'll see what happens.
Yep. That's how it always is. We'll see. We've lived our life, David, in a transition zone for the last decade and a half, and we continue to. I'm just proud of the fact that when I wrote Genesis in 1998, I said the way that it's going to be done is with private enterprise. And here we are, 17 years later, and that's really what's the – and we didn't get anything done with government since then, and it's going to be private enterprise that will do it.
Well, we're not there yet. Let's see what happens.
Well, yeah.
I'll send you some dates to look into the second half of the year.
Okay, very good, David.
Listeners, that's it. And back on Friday morning, Marcia Smith is our guest on Hotel Mars tomorrow night with John Batchelor. We'll be talking about NASA and Russian space policy, so you don't want to miss that. And then Clay Moltz is on Friday morning from the Naval Postgraduate School, and then back again on Sunday with our regular program. Thank you all for listening. Thanks to Bob Zimmerman. Everybody have a great week. Goodbye from Bob and the Space Show.